Hello and welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and yes, it's that time of year. It's time to get cracking. So call us with your gardening questions, 1-800-826-1495. ZestyGarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and you'll see there at the top where you can post a question or comment. So if you're in St. George, you've probably planted peas by now?
I was down in St. George last week of January. Temperatures during the day were about 60. And one of the things, if you remember my rules, okay, we're going to have a little pop quiz here, Brian, and you are the man that is going to get it. The planting depth rule, or the 3X rule, do you remember that one?
You don't plant the seed any deeper than three times its thickness.
As it lays
in your hand.
That's right. So, okay, so you get an A for the day.
And I didn't even study.
Yeah, I know. You usually don't study very much, so I know. You're kind of like me in many
ways.
I've just heard it
so many times, I memorized it.
That's right, but it's important. That's a good place to start. Now, our listeners in St. George and our listeners in Kanab, where it's been relatively warm and there's no snow on the ground, and you can probably start working. Not only do you need to know about the 3X rule, so that means three times the thickness of the seed as it lays in your hand. So if you took any object and laid it in your hand and looked at it the way it naturally rests, you would say, if that's a quarter inch thick, then I would plant it 3/4 inch deep. That's about the location that you want to place it in the soil. Now, when it comes to also determining, it's okay to put it there, but we wouldn't want to do that with a watermelon right now because the ground is cold and it's really likes warmer conditions. So not only do you need to think about the 3X rule, but you also need to know what the temperature is there. And so in the past, we've talked about, you know, getting one of those probing thermometers, those digital thermometers that aren't very expensive, and having one in your garden.
You mean the one melted in the oven?
Oh, did you melt one in your oven?
Yeah.
Well, it happens, you know, and that's why they're cheap, you know. But using that as a indicator tool to say, well, now where that seed is located, what is the temperature? And so planting peas about 3/4 inch is about the right depth. And the temperature in that root zone, right where that seed is placed, should be at the kind of in the peak point during the day. So, and I usually say that's going to be around 2 o'clock in the afternoon or thereabouts. If the temperature is warmer than 50 degrees at that planting depth, you can start to plant. Well, St. George's has been fairly warm. There's been lots of sunshine down there every day, all of those things. And so you can go in and start planting these crops really early. And then the third thing that you need to think about is where do you place, where is your garden relative to the landscape of your yard? And some areas, gardens are a little bit more shady, so they don't warm up nearly as fast. Other ones are always in the sun, so they're going to warm up a lot faster. That can actually change when you would plant, too. So you really need to do a little bit of, understand a little bit of the science. Most of us just want to go do stuff and not think about science because we think science is scary. Science isn't scary if you kind of understand what's going on. And so getting the seed in the right place, knowing the temperature requirements for the particular seeds, and we're going to talk about that, I think, today. And then thinking about your landscape. I always say to people, I know where I live. And where I live is not just a physical address, but it's also, I know something about my landscape. I know where the sunny sides of the sections are. I know where the shady sections are. I know where the warmer sections are. I know the ones that are, you know, I have to watch the water a little bit more because it dries out too much. I know other places where it stays moist and I can minimize the amount. All of those things are the what you know about where you live. And everyone needs to know that. And then if you do those things, gardening then becomes a little bit more enjoyable because you're going to have more success at it.
So with this kind of weather, and I'm just going to kind of launch into what we need to get started right now. I've planted peas in February before up here. Now, it took 2 weeks for them to germinate and then pop up.
Yep.
But every single seed germinated. So what makes a seed like a pea be able to stay in soil colder than they like to germinate, but still be just fine. And then you take a corn seed. If you were to try to do that, it just would eventually just rot.
That's right. And a lot of that comes down to how we classify plants. And we tend to classify vegetables into kind of two broad groups. The one is those that are cold hardy, or the cool season vegetables, we call them, the ones that really like it to be not so hot. And then we have our warm season vegetables. And we can actually divide those groups up into even more categories, those ones that are extra cold hardy and those that are semi-cold hardy. So something like a pea, which is very cold hardy, would be very different than, let's say, a parsnip or something. It's cold hardy, but it likes it a little bit warmer in order for those things to happen. A carrot, the same way. If it's a little on the warmer side, it's going to sprout that much quicker. It will sprout when it's really, really cold, but it just sometimes takes so long that other things go on in the soil that impact the percentage of those seedlings that are going to come up. And it is going to be more influenced by bacteria and fungi that are naturally in the soil. There are soil insects that may be feeding and chewing on them. Much of the solutes that are in the seed are leaking away because it's the membranes are just not organized enough. That's more physiological within the thing. So there are multitudes of factors that can influence. And so a pea will tolerate those kinds of conditions, whereas if we tried to do the same thing with a corn, it wouldn't do it because it's completely in a different group of plants.
So physically, what makes that pea, if you can, boil it down to what makes that pea like those cold temperatures?
Well, at the cellular level, it's how that membrane gets organized. So you have to think about each cell has kind of a rigid wall to it in plants, and then internal to that, there's a flexible membrane. And the cool weather vegetables maintain a great deal of flexibility within their membrane, to think of it quite simply. And as a result of it, that membrane is organized enough that the solution inside that membrane, which is when we take up water into it and you start to solubilize the energy, the carbohydrates and the sugars that are in there, they stay within the membrane. The membrane is what we say not leaky.
They don't rupture.
That's not so much rupturing. It's just that there are channels, there are pores through the membrane, and things can flow in and out. Well, a more organized membrane, particularly in these cooler ones, doesn't allow some of that transfer in and out. And that's, if we're transferring sugars out of the cell, then that's a bad thing because the energy is lost then to the cell. And the cell needs that to function properly and then also to fuel growth and division of those cells, particularly in the root tips and in the shoot tips, so that you get growth. So a pea plant is able to, even under very cold conditions, keep a structured membrane that it doesn't allow that leakiness to occur. And as a result of it, the metabolic processes, now you have to think about the breakdown of energy within the cell and the utilization of that energy to fuel growth, to divide cells, to get another cell which is part of a root that's growing or a shoot that's growing. Those can occur at much, much lower temperatures than, say, with a corn plant. And if we put a corn in cold soil, the membrane isn't structured enough. It's too leaky. It has pores in it that allow things to flow out. And those compounds that flow out then are fuel for other organisms to feed on, like bacteria and fungi, and they tend to function well under less well conditions, and as a result of that, that puts strain on the plant, and oftentimes we'll see effect on germination. So that's the professorial look at it in a very, very simplified way.
But I love it because it tells me what's going on in that plant. I'm not just putting seed in and pulling weeds out. I'm understanding the process.
Yeah. And so our cool weather crops, things like peas and onions and radishes and those kind of plants, which really like and can do that under very cold conditions. Yeah, the process is slow because all of growth is in plants is kind of temperature dependent. And the colder it is, the slower those processes. And that's why it might take 2 or 3 weeks for some of these to emerge. Whereas if the soil was slightly warmer, it might only take 1 to 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And if it's even warmer, it might take 3 or 4 days. And so the warmer the soil is, of course, the process occurs more quickly. But we also have to remember that the timing of events relative to the full growth of the plant. I'm not interested so much in the leaves of peas. I'm interested in the pods and the seeds that are produced by it. I have to be thinking about how long it takes me to get to that flowering stage or that pod growth stage or that seed development stage. And then I need to be planting early enough so that the process of flowering isn't impacted by some environmental condition at that time. And so that's why we usually say with many of these really hardy type vegetables, things like cabbages or kohlrabis or onions or peas, plant them as quickly as you can when the temperature of the soil is at the minimum for when it's going to grow, and as early so that it can mature when it's still cool enough so that we get really high quality product.
So it's all about timing.
Timing is everything. And that's the biggest problem that people have, is because what they think is that all environments are the same. And I said a little earlier, I said, you need to know where you live. And that is not a physical address. It's the environment of where you live. Because up here on the campus, the temperature profile is different than it is in Hyde Park. It's different than even where I live, and I'm not that much lower in the valley relative to the university. But if I was out in the center of the valley, it's very different. And if I live in Mendon, where the mountain shades the afternoon, it's different. And so wherever we live in Utah, whether you live in the Salt Lake Valley, whether you live in the Tooele Valley, whether you live in St. George or in Santa Clara or in Washington Fields, each one of those has a unique environment that's slightly different than something else. And if I say, do this on such and such a date for one area, it might be 5 days different. It might be 10 days different. It might be 3 weeks different, depending on where you are relative to that.
I know my property takes a little bit longer to dry out because the neighbors have these tall ash trees right along the border.
Yeah.
I don't have anything on the east side, but on that west side I do. So I know I've got a plan for those cooler temperatures.
Yep.
And make sure that maybe I delay a little bit when I plant my warm season crops.
Yeah, and if we begin to understand those kinds of things that we give oftentimes the university, when we publish information, we will give you kind of an average. So there's a publication that is out called Suggested Planting Dates, okay, for the Wasatch Front. Well, if you think about the Wasatch Front, that's quite a large distance. It goes from Spanish Fork all the way up to Brigham City, and some people incorporate Cache County into that as well. And if you look at climatological data, if you're up on the bench in Salt Lake City, the temperature profiles, the growing days, all of the things are very different than, let's say, if you were out in West Valley City, because the climates are very, very different relative to those environments. So we give averages, and averages are only just that. You take a whole bunch of information and you compile it together and you add them all up and you divide them by the number that are there, and you say, well, the average planting date for the Salt Lake region is April 1st. Well, on the avenues, it might be March 15, and out in West Valley City, it might be April 15. A whole month different. And so you need to know your environment, and then you need to be able to interpret the information that we give, because I can't give specific information for each home in the state of Utah and be able to provide that to the individuals. That's your job, to kind of figure some of those things out and then use what we learn, what we see, what we read to adjust it accordingly.
Well, and this is where each county extension agent is going to be a big help.
Absolutely. But even they aren't capable of you know, being so precise as to say, you know, this is what's going on. Now, there are some websites that are out there that you can key in your zip code. But, I mean, once again, a zip code is a pretty big area. And it will kind of give you information relative to, you know, how warm it is, when maybe the last frost event is going to be, when the first fall frost is going to be, what the growing season is going to be like, what the average temperature might be like. You know, that's a good place to start, but you still have to kind of be a little bit smarter than that and say, well, what's unique about where I live? Like you say, I've got these trees along my western border in Hyde Park. I know that I can't really plant up close to them, but as if I get farther out into my garden or farther away from them, it actually is warmer. Or I've got this sunny location over here, and maybe that's what I'm going to plant my earliest crops in, and I've got this other location that I have to wait with. Those are the kinds of things that we want our audience to start thinking about as they look at their own landscape.
Well, we hope that you'll join our conversation. Dan Drost, USU's extensive vegetable specialist, is in studio. So call us at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495, or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, and you'll notice today's conversation there at the top, and you'll be able to post your question or comment there. So what should we get started right now? Indoors. I mean, it's, at least in Cache County, there, you can't do anything outside unless you've maybe set up a
Well, if you had your high tunnel up and running, yeah. You know, but even then, you know, we've been in our high tunnels, and the bigger problem that we've had over the last 10 days is what? We have had fog every day, and so there's not a lot of radiant energy that's coming into that. Mm. The sun hasn't shined. I mean, it's the sunshine that comes into those structures that help warm them up. And, you know, when it's really foggy like this, the radiation load coming in there is really not a lot to help you drive the temperature upward. So as we look at our temperature profiles, even in our tunnels, it hasn't shifted too much up relative to what it is outside. So things even in there aren't going to be doing that great this year, just simply because we've got quite a bit of snow cover. We've got this high pressure system. We've got a lot of atmospheric humidity. And as a result of that, you generate fog. And if the fog is thick enough and it's there every day, you know, you aren't going to warm things up too much. But that doesn't mean you can't do some things. I recommend the first thing that you do at this time of the year is, besides sitting in your Barco lounger and reading seed catalogs and dreaming about how I'm going to get more melons out of my garden and how I'm going to get earlier tomatoes and how I'm going to, you know, deal with problem X, Y, and Z, do an inventory of what seed you have. Okay, I think that's always a good place to start in February. You know, look at your seed inventory. I was in the refrigerator downstairs last night, and there was my jars of seed. And so I kind of thought to myself, well, that's a good place for me to start this weekend, is to pull those seeds out, look at when I purchased them, because I've got some jars that I know that have seed in them from quite a few years ago, and there's quite a bit of seed still in those packages that I can plant. And I was thinking about my lettuce that's going to go into my side yard where I get a lot of sun, my raised bed, it's right up against my brick wall of my home, and I was thinking, well, if the snow comes off of those in the next 10 days, I'm going to start seeding lettuce and spinach, so I got my spring salad garden, right? That's my plan. So, but I don't know anything about how that seed is going to perform. I'm assuming that it's good, but I don't know. And, you know, there was an old comedy regime that talked about assuming stuff. And when you do that, you usually make a mistake. You think it's good and it really isn't. And so I'm going to go take some of those seeds this weekend, wrap them in paper towels, moisten it, and stick them in a warm spot in the house where I've got some good temperatures, and I'm going to get sprout them, because if I have 50% germination, that tells me I need to, I can use the seed, I just need to sow it twice as thick in order to get the number of plants that I want. If it's 25% germination, I'm going to probably purchase some new lettuce seed or some new radish seeds or spinach seeds and that type of thing, because the date on the package might say 2010, but even if it's 2010, if I've kept them in my refrigerator in a sealed jar under good conditions, they should still germinate at a high percentage, but I need to know that. So usually we recommend at least 20 seeds wrapped in some moist paper towel, put into a plastic bag, but you don't really seal the plastic bag up completely because that plants do need a little bit of oxygen, even though there's probably enough oxygen in that. And then put them on in a warm place where the temperature is about 70 to 75 degrees, and then watch them for a few days and watch them sprout. And if the little root comes out of them, you call them sprouted. And if that number is 50%, then I'll plant twice as much. If it's 75%, that tells me I don't need to plant as much. If it's 100%, all the seeds are sprouting, then I know I can just plant them out as I normally would. And that's a good way to inventory things. And it also then will tell you what you're short of. Oh, I need some more of this variety of lettuce because I really like that one. Or I don't have very much carrot seed, so I can start to make a list of things that I'm going to need to purchase so that when the snow goes away, I can quickly get into my garden and start planting some of these cooler weather vegetables that are going to mature before the heat of summer, and I can get things going.
Now, there are some seed that tends to be worse in their viability from one year to the next.
Like, yeah.
Usually onions, I tend to just buy new onions every year.
Yeah, and I think if you, purchased onion seed last year, and then you as soon as you got your onions planted and you stuck them in a jar, with a good seal lid to them, you probably are okay this year. 1 to 2 years we usually say with onions is good. But I would probably test them anyway to be certain. And they're not, it seems like a little bit of work, but, I count pennies. We pay attention to the money in the house. You see the stock market going crazy and you kind of say to yourself, well, if I don't have to buy new seed this year, that's good. I don't have to do it. If I do need to buy certain things, then I'm going to buy those things. But one of the things that I, if I grow it, parsnips are notorious for like living only for 1 year. So you always buy, if you grow parsnips, you should always buy fresh seed every year. If I have tomatoes that I'm going to grow my own plants of, they live for 10, 15 years with very little loss in the germination percentage of the seed, provided, once again, it's stored in cool, dry conditions. So the mason jar with a good lid to it is the dry, and my refrigerator is the cool. And I just have a series of mason jars in the lower shelf in my refrigerator that are there for that. Now, plastic bags, I don't like them so much because they're kind of porous and they kind of hydrate within that a little bit. And so you're going to lose that. So a good mason jar rather than something plastic. I mean, they tend to be a little bit more leaky. And then test it. That's the key thing. So 20 seeds. You're going to be able to figure out right away that what percentage germination you have.
So you can put them in a refrigerator in a jar. So that sounds good. If you don't have a refrigerator, but you have a cool place in the basement,
yeah, in your
that'll
fruit
work.
Your fruit cellar is an appropriate place because your fruit cellar area is underneath the porch, and many homes have those kinds of areas. It's 45 or so. That's probably okay.
But it's still better to put them
in
a jar.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of moisture still that can be in the basement.
Exactly. So. And so if you just kind of take your seeds and you stick them in a cardboard box and throw them on the shelf someplace, whether it be in your garage or down your basement or who knows where. Those are the ones that are under the worst conditions. Those are going to dry out. They're going to rehydrate. They're going to be exposed to cool. They're going to be exposed to warm. All of those things tend to create conditions within the seed that move it toward losing its germination percentage. Okay? And so those are the ones that I'd really want to test. Or if you do buy seeds, don't buy really more than you think you need. And that way, you're always going to get fresh seed, because all of the nurseries and all of the garden centers, they don't really save seed from year to year to year. They buy fresh seed in from a company, and that company has raised those plants in the past year. So they're only a year old, so they're going to have the highest percentage of seeds that are going to germinate.
I've wondered when I've gone into a garden center to get bulk seed, if that seed is left over from the year before.
I can't speak to that, but that isn't a bad question to ask. Are you buying in new bulk seed every year, or do you have carryover bulk seed from the previous year? And how do I ensure, and how do you ensure to me as a proprietor of a business, how do you assure to your customer that you're getting good quality seed rather than I'm just selling you, you know, the whatever I had left over, and because I've got this inventory that I need to unload. And so that's another reason. If he says, well, we do carry some seed over and we have a sale on it, you know, that might be okay to do it, but I would say then test it. You know, make sure you go do a germination test on it so that you have some idea. Because there's nothing more frustrating in gardening to say, I put out a row of seeds and very few of them come up. You know, because now you've got all this time that you've invested in it up front. You've got the time that the seed is germinating out in the garden that's been wasted. And then you have to replant, so that's more time. And then the crop is maturing maybe when it's too hot and the quality of the product and to be impacted by those kinds of conditions. So it's always wise, and this is a great time to do that because we got very little else to do, you know, when there's snow on the ground and it's cold and the days are short. So, you know, use your time to kind of get yourself prepped for it. And then read those seed catalogs, of course, and think about all the other things that you don't have or you haven't ever tried to grow that you maybe want to learn about. And then go to the Extension website that the university has, or download the app, even better. There's an app that talks about, has all the gardening fact sheets on it that are related to vegetables and fruits. And you can download that app and you can just have them on your phone. And you can, you know, if you're out in the garden or out in the garage or wherever you are, you can say, oh, what do I need to know about growing, you know, Belgian endive? What do I need to know about growing radicchio? What do I need to know about growing rhubarb? And I can learn more about those types of things to you know, kind of enhance my gardening experience in 2016.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and I hope you'll call with your question or comment. It's 1-800-826-1495. You can email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. He's my guest for about another 9 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495. Or you can also send us an email question, zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. So let's get right down into looking at what can we start indoors right now to get ready to go.
Well, you know, because your listening audience is stretched from, let's see, almost up to Soda Springs down to, you know, northern
Mesquite,
Arizona.
Nevada.
Yeah, Mesquite. Yeah, because I've heard it there. I mean, you know, so we've got this huge environmental range that we're focusing our attention on. But I'm going to give you think about it a little bit differently. I'm going to tell you how long it takes to grow a plant to appropriate transplant size. And then I don't know where you live. I know where I live. So figure out where you live relative to the environmental conditions and then back yourself up that many weeks in order to kind of get into it. So if you're going to grow broccoli transplants or cauliflower or cabbage or something like that, depending on how big you like your plant to be before it goes out in your vegetable garden, it takes generally 6 to 8 weeks to grow that plant up to transplantable size. So thinking about that, if you were in Let's say Logan here. Normally in Logan, we would start planting, we could start planting broccolis toward the middle of April. Okay, so 6 to 8 weeks is going to, 6 to 8 weeks is going to be just about now that I have to do that, right? So we're middle of February, middle of March, middle of April, 8 weeks. And if I would start transplanting them, if I had a protected spot, that would be a good way to do it.
Would that include kohlrabi?
It could, yes. Okay. All of those are in that group. So, and then if I'm going to grow the leafy greens, let's say lettuce and spinach and chards and some of those, because I like to transplant them for some early stuff, I seed them also at the same time, then it's going to take 4 to 5 weeks to grow those. If I'm going to grow onions and celery from transplants, usually that's like 10 weeks, maybe up to 12 weeks, depending on what the conditions are like. So those would be the crops that I would start now. I wouldn't be planting tomatoes yet. We're going to wait a month to do that. I wouldn't be doing peppers. I wouldn't be doing melons. Those are going to be things that we'll talk about when I come in March. And I'll be back in March to talk, and then I'll give people the appropriate dates. So, but if you're down in St. George, you should be transplanting broccolis. You should be transplanting onions. You should be transplanting your lettuces if you haven't already seeded all those types of things. So that's the problem that we have in this state. You know, that's like I talk about Logan. Well, people say, well, I don't know anything else but where I live. So, you know, we have to use the resources that are available to us.
We have a phone call. We have a caller from Mendon. We have Steve. Hi, Steve. How can we help?
Hey, you know, I grew up in Virginia and Maryland, and, of course, that's a good peanut country.
Uh-huh.
I went on the USU Extension page, and it talked about how you could grow peanuts in Cache Valley.
Yep.
I am trying to figure out any other tips that might be available to me. I want to give it a go. It's been a lot of years, and my kids have never had the experience of pulling goober peas out of the ground.
Yeah, cool.
So I thought it'd be pretty cool for
yeah.
that.
Yeah, you know, you got to be from back east to call them goobers, so. But, yeah, what I would recommend that you do is, you know, instead of growing them on a flat surface out in your vegetable garden, raise up a bed, you know, so mound up some soil. The main thing what we're going to do that for is that's going to get some warmth in it. You're probably not going to plant plants out or seeds out until late May with those. And then also when you're purchasing your seed, purchase short maturing types. So you're going to want 90-day yeah. maturity types because you're over in Mendon. Remember, the shade comes quite early in the afternoon there. You don't get quite the heat that you get. Sure, the sun comes up early, but it's still a little bit cooler on that side of the valley than it is on the other side of the valley. And so your mounding will help. And then, you know, if because the way the peanut grows, it actually has to grow the flower above ground, but then a part of the flower grows down underneath the soil in order to form the peanut, you're going to maybe over time have to throw some more soil up around that plant in order to make sure that that occurs appropriately. Okay?
All right.
So later planting, shorter maturing varieties, you know, in that 90-day classification, a mounded bed is going to warm up quicker and wait till the end of May to start doing this stuff. All right?
How deep would you mound it?
Well, start out with your mound maybe 4 or 5 inches tall, and then you're going to throw more soil up there as the plant starts growing. Because
so like a potato, you just keep peeling
it
up?
Yeah, because what you're really trying to do is bury the flower. The peanut will not form if the flower stays above the soil. Okay, yeah. So naturally it grows, forces itself down in there, but you can help it by mounding soil up just like we would around potatoes. So, Steve, good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for your call. Just a couple of minutes left here for your conversation with Dan Drost, 1-800-826-1495, or zestygarden@gmail.com, or the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. So, so looking at the seeds for most of these cruciferous vegetables, they're pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to be putting them in the soil very much, maybe actually just pressing them in.
Yeah, you know, if we're going to grow them in a little pot or something like that, you know, normally I would just sprinkle them right on the surface. I'd make sure my soil mix is tapped firmly into the container that I'm growing it in. I'd then sprinkle the seed right on the surface, and then I'd put maybe no more than 1/4 inch of new soil mix on top of that. and then you're going to water it. And then the other thing that you can do is just take like Saran wrap or something like that and lay it over top of the tray until you start seeing those little seedlings sprouting up. What that will do is it'll keep you from wanting to add more water. And the Saran wrap itself will help hold the moisture in there and will help keep the moist the surface moist where those seeds are located. Because one of the tendencies we have in a home is we tend to kind of, I think I need some more water on it. And oftentimes we keep it too wet. And so that then aggravates the ability of that seed to germinate. And so just some Saran wrap over the top of it or something like that.
Or one of those domes.
Yeah, anything just to keep the humidity up a little will make it work. So I don't have a dome. I just throw some plastic over the top of it. And it can be any kind of plastic. It doesn't even need to be opaque. It could, you could, a solid sheet of it, sometimes I stick my trays in an old plastic grocery bag or something like that and use them that way just to keep the humidity up. And it's also, more importantly, is to keep me from continually adding water to it because that's when I create problems for myself. And then a warm place, and the place that I like to sprout my seeds on is I stick them right on top of my hot water heater. My hot water heater is always warm. Put your hand up there. It's always pretty nice and warm. And then it's just a matter of watching for the seeds sprout. And once they sprout, then you move them where the sunlight is, or you put them under a grow lamp or however you find it's useful for you to grow your plants, because each person has their own approach to doing these things. But the key thing is warmth to get them to sprout, not too moist, and then once they're sprouted, bright light. And that's why we often recommend, you know, growing them under fluorescent lamps or something that are really close to the plant so that it's really, really high intense light. And then you get that nice squat, rigid, compact growth on the plant, which makes for a good transplant.
Dan, thank you very much.
It always goes too fast, Brian. So I'll see you the first part of next month.
Every first Thursday beginning.
The first Thursday of every month we'll be here to talk about vegetables.
Well, in our, we've got a gardening calendar. I wanted to go through a couple of items. USU Extension in Cache County presents a seed selection and planning your garden class. It's on Friday, February 19th. So this Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. in the multipurpose room of the Cache County building. It's free and open to everyone, but registration is required. Call 752-6263 for more information. And the Utah House at the USU Botanical Center in Kaysville presents a class on the basics of starting your own seeds. You'll learn how to save money and get a head start on the growing season. The class is Wednesday evening, February 24th from 6 to 7 p.m. Registration information can be found at usubotanicalcenter.org. If you have an item for the Zesty Garden calendar, wherever you listen to us, let me know about it by sending us an email. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can call me at 797-3107. Dan, thanks for coming in.
See you next month.
Coming up next is Petals and Prose.
I'm Nancy Williams, and I'm back here, gratefully back here with the Zesty Garden, which is my wonderful, my fun time to read things that I love and share them with you. And since it's January and we are in Utah, there's not a whole lot any of us can do in an outside garden at this point. And there's a limit to how many things we can find that are worth sharing from the seed catalogs. So I will be sharing with you some of my other garden-related favorites. One of those comes from one of my favorite cookbooks called With a Measure of Grace, The Story and Recipes of a Small Town Restaurant, which is written about probably my favorite restaurant in Utah right now, Hell's Backbone Grill, which is down in Boulder, Utah. So it's an area that I have long loved in southern Utah. And the stories and the recipes from this restaurant are just delightful. I hope you enjoy them. I'm going to start with a little introduction to the two women who run this restaurant and how they happened to get there from Flagstaff, Arizona. So I'm going to read you from the cookbook a piece that precedes the recipes by Terry Tempest Williams, also a fine Utah writer, called Prayer Flags in the Desert. She writes, It was with some trepidation that I left the town of Torrey and drove down Highway 12, heading toward Boulder for a gathering of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. I realized that I hadn't been in Garfield County since the spring of 1997, when the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument was less than a year old. Back then, the town seemed raw. The new monument, yet another insult, threatening their unabashed frontier lifestyle. Most residents made themselves emotionally off-limits to outsiders who visited the wild and vast areas now federally protected. The rest were just plain mad and not hesitant to show it. Dark glares beneath sweat-stained ball caps, curtly spoken, few-worded answers to innocent questions, one-dimensional exchanges in convenience stores, no conversation, no eye contact, only money moving hand to hand. The air was cold and thick with unspoken resentments. Locals saw no need for more protection of the landscape they'd assumed was theirs since Brigham Young sent their ancestors down to spread his gospel. Why protect godforsaken land that had done a fairly good job of protecting itself? They saw the new monument only from the perspective of rural economics. Any additional protection would attract more people, making a difficult living more so. Tourists were a nuisance and a distraction from the real work of real people. But not everyone feels this way. The red-hot sandstone is a magnet for passionate engagement, a sensual landscape that inspires love, a wild terrain to be explored and respected. For decades, people from all over the United States have become involved in efforts to protect Utah's Red Rock Wilderness. The Escalante Canyons are at the heart of this proposal. America's Red Rock Wilderness Act is now a bill before Congress, with hundreds of co-sponsors in the House of Representatives, dozens of sponsors committed in the Senate, all of whom acknowledge the rarity of this landscape of the imagination. Red rocks and ravens, serpentine canyons, and maidenhair ferns that decorate water-drenched grottos seep into our DNA. We are changed on a cellular level and begin to see the world differently. We remember why the desert is holy, a place for pilgrims in search of peace. We touch stone and find an opening. Erosions of rock inspires an erosion of our own calcified nature. I was nervous to return to Boulder. The last time I was there, somebody threw a rock at my car. I didn't understand until later when I realized I had a Wild Utah sticker on my rear bumper. Coming from rural Mormon stock myself, I understood the grimness, the grittiness, the calluses, the leave-me-alone nature of scraping a living out of the very canyons whose beauty attracts travelers from around the world. I wish there were a bridge between these seemingly different worldviews that could move us across the chasm of us versus them. But it's a difficult bridge to find. Even harder one to build or to hold within one's own heart. But in May 2003, when I checked into Boulder Mountain Lodge, something had changed. It felt different. I looked around. An elegant, lush garden with a statue of Buddha in the center greeted me. Daylilies waved in the breeze. Prayer flags hung outside Hell's Backbone Grill. And then I remembered hearing about the two women who had taken over the restaurant a few years earlier. Word was these women were outsiders, like the rest of us, only different. They came to Boulder not just to hike and commune with the desert, but to live and work. They hired the children of local ranchers, grew most of their own food, and created recipes that corresponded to what was available in each season. And no, they were not Mormons like 90% of those who live in Boulder, but somehow that didn't matter. These two women, I found out later that night at dinner, are Blake Spaulding and Jen Castle. They came to Boulder from Flagstaff, Arizona, with enormous skill, developed during years of cooking for commercial river companies and in other remote campgrounds around the American West. They brought with them baskets of instinct and secrets about the power of food and its potential for glory. Blake sat down with us at our table. Our eyes met. We shared stories. She told of going to the town council meeting shortly after they arrived in Boulder and explaining how in order to make this restaurant a viable business, they would need a liquor license. This issue had come up before the town on a previous occasion with a different restaurant owner and had been deeply divisive within the community. The women conveyed their respect for Mormon beliefs and that they meant no harm. The community listened to the calm, thoughtful approach of this new enterprise that promised to feed an open spirit of cooperation in town. Finally, one of the LDS councilmen said, "Nobody ever talked to us like this before. They only yelled." He paused. "I'm going to have to think hard about this." Hell's Backbone Grill received its liquor license, and its doors have been open ever since, delighting travelers who come for rest and sanctuary at Boulder Mountain Lodge. The locals are developing a particular pride around the restaurant. It has become an oasis in the desert. I stood outside after dinner watching dusk glow on the cliffs before they turned dark and disappeared. Call it the encore light that glistens long after the sun sets. I took in deep breaths, aware of the fresh mint recently planted, and thought about how good this place felt, how peaceful, with much of the rawness and glares gone, and how change is possible when two people accept the power that they have to make a difference in the world. Blake and Jen brought something with them when they came to Boulder, Utah, something that can't be measured or named. Call it spirit, or knowledge with a capital K, or just plain guts, but whatever their gifts, they allow us to see the magic that occurs when we choose to come to a place with an intention to create history. What I love most about Hell's Backbone Grill is its ongoing story of restoration and reconciliation within a community known for its contention. It is not easy to enter a new town, especially a town like Boulder, Utah, that prides itself on insiders, locals, and natives. Genealogy is the primary ticket for access. And it is especially difficult to enter a Mormon community in the outback and ask for a liquor license, a request that first rolls down the aisle of the church like a cherry bomb, threatening to shatter the dominant culture's word of wisdom that forbids coffee, tea, and alcohol. But this is exactly what Blake Spaulding and Jen Castle did in the spring of 2000. They asked the citizens of Boulder, Utah for a spiritual accommodation. "We listened," said Blake. "We listened to the people who live here and share our belief in a vision of beautiful food and beautiful country. Many folks said we were crazy, that we wouldn't be able to find staff, that we wouldn't be able to keep our doors open in such remote country. But both Jen and I felt called to this landscape." I thought about that bridge I'd been wishing for and realized that a bridge might be too fragile and therefore temporary. What Blake and Jen have quietly done is fill in that gap, that dividing space between neighbors, with mindfulness, and they have filled it with the sacred nature of food. The Buddha says breathing is a quivering intake of life. At Hell's Backbone Grill, so is eating. There are many forms of grace, especially in the desert. It is a landscape of prayers where one falls on hands and knees in gratitude for the splash of water that is not a mirage. Hell's Backbone Grill is a place of such grace. It is water in the desert. The name is harsh like the country, but if you dare to enter in, dust off your shoulders and let your eyes adjust to the peace outside and inside, you will find within its unexpected embrace deep nourishment born out of struggle and love. What lingers after a slow, thoughtful dinner is love. We are reminded through the creative hands of these believing women that daily renewal is possible through the loving gesture of a meal dreamed and shared. I'm going to share with you a recipe from Hell's Backbone Grill. I have to confess I haven't made it, but it is a fabulous recipe and I'm going to make it. So it is also one of their signature recipe. They wanted to have a signature sauce. And so they came up with something they call backbone sauce. And they write, "We consider this an upgrade of Utah's unofficial condiment, fry sauce, ketchup, and mayonnaise. It's delicious on a grilled burger with melted sharp white cheddar and caramelized onions, on BLTs, or as a dip for artichokes. Here is the simple but fabulous recipe for backbone sauce. Half a cup of sour cream, a cup of mayonnaise, one or two chipotle peppers, include the adobo sauce in which they're packed, 2 tablespoons of cumin, 2 cloves of roasted garlic, 1 red pepper roasted and peeled, the juice of 1 lime, and 2 tablespoons of chopped cilantro. In a food processor fitted with a blade, whirl together everything, all the ingredients. Scrape down the sides and process till it's smooth. End of recipe. We can all do that, right? Try it. You won't be sorry. I'm Nancy Williams for Zesty Garden. You can find that recipe on the webpage for Zesty Garden at upr.org. Click the link for Zesty Garden, and it will be at the end of this reading. Bon appetit, or however you say that in Spanish, because that's what it should be. See you next time.
Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.